Welcome back to Across the Movie Aisle, presented by Bulwark Plus. I am your host, Sonny Bunch, culture editor of The Bulwark. I am joined, as always, by Alyssa Rosenberg of The Washington Post and Peter Suderman of Reason Magazine. Alyssa, Peter, how are you today?
I'm well.
I am happy to be talking about movies with friends.
First up in controversies and non-controversies, Disney finds itself caught between a rock, its employees and progressives on Twitter, and a hard place, the politicians of Florida and conservatives on Twitter, in a double bind practically designed in a lab to give new CEO Bob Chapek a blinding headache. The issue at hand is the so-called Don't Say Gay bill, right? You've got proponents of the, I guess it's a law now. Did it get signed? Is it the law or the, it doesn't matter. Proponents of the bill suggest it is merely an effort to keep discussion of sexuality out of classrooms away from younger children, the idea being that kindergartners don't need to learn about thruples and transgenderism and the such. Critics of the bill, like The Bulwark's own Tim Miller, say that it is written so broadly that a gay teacher could not talk about their own marriage in front of their classroom kids without risking getting fired. That's a problem. One of the biggest employers in Florida is Disney, and their massive theme park, Disney World, makes them one of the most powerful figures in the state. Theoretically, anyway. Chapek understands that Disney's power is pretty limited to the economic reality on the ground. Consider, for instance, the carve-out Disney helped insert into an anti-tech company bill Florida passed last year that would require sites to host speech they disagree with. Here was the language in the bill. Quote, "The term for the business does not include any information service, system, internet search engine, or access software provided operated by a company that owns and operates a theme park or an entertainment complex," end quote. It's very subtle what they're carving out there. As a matter of pure culture war, and let's be honest, this is just a pure culture war, Disney's options are fairly limited, and Chapek knows this. It's why the Don't Say Gay law, when it was first kicking up, he demurred from inserting the Mouse House into the dust-up entirely. Here's what he initially said. Quote, "As we have seen time and again, corporate statements do very little to change outcomes or minds. Instead, they are often weaponized by one side or the other to further divide and inflame. Simply put, they can be counterproductive and undermine more effective ways to achieve change," end quote. This is 100% correct. It's just correct. That's just true. Naturally, his employees lost their minds as a result. They demanded Disney immediately denounce the bill, cut off political donations to Florida, et cetera, et cetera. Chapek ended up doing this, which in turn gave Florida Governor Ron DeSantis exactly what he wanted, an opportunity to stand up against the quote-unquote woke corporation undermining the values of the constituents. Here's a fundraising letter that DeSantis and his campaign sent out this morning. Quote, "Woke Disney is now echoing Democrat propaganda and falling for the corporate media's phony hysteria over a Florida bill that sensibly prohibits K to third graders from being indoctrinated with transgenderism and R-rated lessons about sexuality," end quote. Now, some people will argue that human rights matter more than giving the GOP a win with their base. Maybe that's true. Maybe it's not. I'm not going to dispute that one way or the other. What Disney definitely is, though, is literally the worst company in the world to make this case. Any stance that they take is going to be mired in accusations of hypocrisy, and they're totally credible. For instance, they pulled Turning Red from Russia, right? But they let it play in Saudi Arabia, a nation that literally punishes acts of homosexuality with fines, public beatings, and execution. They condemn the Don't Say Gay bill in Florida or voter suppression in Georgia, but they say nothing about ethnic cleansing in China or that nation's forbidding of the portrayal of quote-unquote effeminate men, right? It's hypocrisy all the way down there in a total no-win situation unless they start pulling movies from everywhere. Peter, was Chapek's first instinct right? Or was it smart of him to cave to his more vocal employees and who were demanding that the company take a stand?
Well, as you described this, I thought of two things. And the first one was just the concept of the scissor, which is a concept introduced by the blogger who has sometimes gone under the name Slightstar Codex, who talked several years ago about cultural and political news events that were seemingly perfectly calibrated to divide people and to be impossible to solve. And I just feel like the last 5 to 7 years, basically since Donald Trump went down the escalator and started to run for president, have just been nothing but scissors. And now Disney is caught in yet another one. And there's no great answer for someone like that, because a CEO of a company like Disney on the one hand, has to work with the politicians who are the leaders in the areas that the company operates in. Also has to cater to people who may or may not share political viewpoints, and also has to manage a quite large staff, and which in the case of Disney is going like inherently to lean to the left. In the United States, a media company that hires a lot of artists and performers and creative types, like whether or not that should be the case, whether or not that is like a necessary historical outcome. In 2022, it's just the case that a company like that is going to have a bunch of people who lean to the left. And so a CEO there is to some extent caught in a sort of miniature scissor, a sort of a situation through which there's absolutely no way out and which is just inherently going to divide people. But the other thing I thought about was an interview that Chapek's predecessor in the Disney CEO role gave recently to Kara Swisher of the New York Times. This was framed as an exit interview for Bob Iger's tenure at Disney. And she asked him about doing business in China and other places with that don't share American values. And he gave this sort of vague, sort of hemmy-hawy answer that ultimately resolved into, well, look, obviously, we have concerns about the various situations around the globe. But in the end, you have to do business sometimes in some places with political classes, with rules and regulations, with governments that you don't necessarily agree with. And sometimes that does mean that at times you have to compromise on values. But we're not necessarily in the values business. We're in the business. And I'm paraphrasing and in some ways sharpening his point just a little bit. His was arguably a little bit more vague than what I just said, but basically said, look, you have to do business in places, and doing business is not about necessarily just putting values first, even though obviously you would like to make sure that your values are represented there. And I think that that's just an incredibly tricky thing for CEOs of these mass international corporations, but even national corporations now that are based in California or New York and have to do business in Texas and Florida, where increasingly Texas and Florida are legal and political regimes where the laws are expressing different values than the values of CEOs and creative types in big blue states.
Yeah, Alyssa, I mean, I'm curious to get your take on this, because I do think that you have written more about the ethical implications of consumerism and that sort of thing. And I want to get your opinion on this, but it really does seem to me like the solution to the scissor is for companies simply to not be ethical or political watchdogs in that sort of way.
Yeah, I think this is a complicated calculation, probably more complicated than Disney's employees are giving it credit for. But what I found really interesting about Chapek's original statement is it was the rare time that I've seen a Hollywood CEO lay out, however weakly, sort of a theory of the case for how entertainment businesses can bring about social change. And what was more striking than the fact that he was saying that the content can help produce social change by, making people feel empathetic to members of communities that they don't have regular contact with, that they're not a part of. I mean, that's been part of Hollywood spiel for a long time. I mean, going back to the movies of the civil rights era, certainly, Will and Grace, Philadelphia, et cetera. But what he was actually saying that was negative, sort of more striking, which is that he was coming out and saying, look, our public intervention in these issues is often not particularly helpful. And I think that is probably arguably true. Now, the entertainment industry is very good at certain kinds of lobbying. There are, all sorts of academic papers about the impact that Hollywood has had on various, trade treaties. The industry is incredibly good at extracting tax breaks from, local and state governments. Florida is actually debating whether to reinstitute a tax credit bill because it's been losing so much filming business to Georgia, which has huge tax incentives for filming. And so the entertainment industry is very good and very invested in lobbying on issues that are key to its business, right? That are key to, extracting the money and the cooperation that it takes to make movies in various places. but it is more complicated when they are in the position of lobbying about issues that may be highly salient to their employees. And look, if you have a bunch of employees in Florida, if you're Disney, it's not just that a bunch of them are going to be liberal; it's that some of them are going to be gay and they're going to have families and are now thinking about what happens when my kid, you know, draws a picture of me and my wife at school, and some kid asks, you know, why you have two mommies instead of a dad, and you know, a kindergarten teacher is now like, well, do I answer the question or do I risk getting sued? Right? I mean, that's a kind of rotten environment for your in-state employees to have to deal with, but it's not key to your business as Disney, right? I mean, you know, Disney's not actually producing any content that, if shown in a Florida classroom to a bunch of second graders, like, you know, would be about gay people. It's not, you know, it's not a core business concern. And so this is not a bill that the entertainment industry is necessarily going to be effective at lobbying about because it's not actually their core competency. But it's also a situation where, you know, they're kind of stuck in some ways, right? I mean, in part because the language around this bill has gotten so ugly in like right-wing media and otherwise. There's a lot of conversation about this being like an anti-grooming bill, which is language designed to sort of conflate like the existence of gay people and old, really nasty canards that suggest that gay people are sexual predators, that they're trying to convert kids because, you know, it's like we're all, you know, people are running around with pamphlets on street corners being like, hey, have you heard about homosexuality? And Disney, because it is a business that is aimed at families and children, is sort of uniquely in danger of getting caught up in this kind of rhetoric in a way that is crucial to their core business. So, you know, they are, of all the entertainment industry companies, the one that is sort of most likely to have some problems if they step into the fray here. It's not clear why, you know, I think they don't speak with particular moral authority on this issue, as you said, Sunny. And so the idea that the entertainment industry is going to get out of the lobbying business, period, doesn't really make sense because that's part of what they do. It's part of how they handle the budgets on these ginormous movies. It's like by getting 30% back in rebates from Georgia. So they're not going to stop lobbying. They're not going to stop political contributions. But there is this sort of, you know, there's this sense that
this bill doesn't threaten their ability to do business in Florida, except in the sense that if they have an actual staff uprising, that's an issue for them, especially right now. And I mean, again, this came up in the Kerry Swisher interview with Chapek's predecessor, Bob Iger. And it was just about like, it's really difficult for large corporations to fill positions right now, especially the sort of not super well paid. I mean, not necessarily like bottom of the barrel, but like not necessarily super well paid theme park type jobs. Those type of positions right now.
Hourly you need wage someone in the Mickey workers, suit, right?
Like hourly wage work is actually quite difficult. And so it is. That is going to give workers more power just inherently. Yeah. And so in most cases, workers are going to use that power, like on average, to bargain for wages and benefits and better hours, that sort of thing, right? Like the stuff that like lifestyle and financial things that they want. But there is a way that at the margins, at least, workers who want to, let's call it, consume political activism as a fringe benefit at their workplace are going to use a moment of enhanced leverage for labor to push bosses in the political direction that they want. Now, that may not be good for the bottom line, ultimately. Like, it's definitely theoretically possible that that's a bad idea just from a bottom line perspective, strictly. But you do have to, you know, like, leadership does have to listen to labor to some extent. Yeah.
I don't think the bottom line really matters much here. My argument is that it's a bad move politically. It's a bad political tactic to give Ron DeSantis this win. If you are a progressive who is concerned about progressive ideals, what you have just done is you have handed Ron DeSantis the thing he wants, which is a fight with a big woke corporation, and you are giving every other Republican governor with presidential aspirations a game plan to do the same exact thing and get into the same exact business. But like I just think that this is from a purely tactical point of view. If you are a progressive employee of Disney, and you are looking at this and you're thinking, finally, we've defeated DeSantis because they're cutting off the donations, and that you're looking at this short-sightedly and foolishly.
Yeah.
You have made an enormous tactical mistake.
Yeah. But I mean, Aaron Sorkin and Twitter have taught a generation of progressives that political fights are won by a speech smackdown,
likes and retweets,
right? Like,
yeah.
By a great tweet or a great line, by saying this person is really bad in a clever way. And I mean, this is true on the right as well. Like, it's not just progressives who have fallen for this. But there is this idea of politics that the way to win is just to stand up and, like, forthrightly say, this person's bad, when they do something that you don't like, rather than actually thinking through the consequences of what happens after that.
Right. And Bob Chapek's mistake was thinking that he was in a situation where people were asking him to do something tactical rather than that they were asking him to effectively do workplace management and provide affirmation that the company's bosses were on the same side as the employees.
Yeah. So what do we think? Is it a controversy or a non-controversy that Disney has jumped with both feet into this culture war fight? Peter?
Oh, totally a controversy.
Alyssa?
Controversy.
It is a controversy, and it is a real mistake. They should not have done that. All right, a quick programming reminder. Rather than posting both episodes of Across Movie Isle on Tuesday, as we've been doing, we have decided to spread the love a bit. Main episodes go up on Tuesday, and they will be available simultaneously on Substack and your preferred podcast app, iTunes, et cetera, et cetera. The bonus episode will post on Fridays, and it will continue to only be available to members of Bulwark Plus. So go to atma.thebulwark.com. Get signed up if you want that special members-only bonus episode. This week, we're talking about some of our favorite Pixar movies and what the animation studio does and how they're so good at doing it. Speaking of Pixar, on to the main event. Turning Red, which Disney decided to dump on Disney Plus in the United States rather than play in theaters for even a limited amount of time before moving it to the streaming service. We can talk about that more in a minute. I have thoughts. But first, let's talk about the movie itself. Turning Red is about a girl named Maylin, who one might describe as something between precocious and deeply annoying, an overachiever and a narc, a nerd with overbearing parents, a girl who loves boy bands and, you know, boys. She is humiliated by her mom one evening when her erotic doodles are displayed to her classmates. An emotionally catastrophic event that results in her turning into a giant red panda, aka that panda that looks more like a raccoon than an actual panda bear. It's a trash panda, folks. I will not move off this position. Apparently, this is a thing that happens with women in Maylin's family around the onset of puberty, and this is so unsubtle a metaphor for the onset of puberty that they make the subtext text by waving around maxi pads and the such. Emotional duress sparks a monstrous transformation. Maylin, perturbed by this at first, soon realizes that her profound powers make her special and that she can become the most popular girl in school by turning into the panda and taking Polaroids with her classmates. In other words, that's right, this is basically Teen Wolf, but with a red panda instead of a werewolf, and it's set in 2002 for some reason, and also it's in Toronto. Because we can't have nice things, there has been some controversy surrounding reviews of the film, or honestly, just one review that got really dragged all up and down Twitter, and then it was in Variety and elsewhere. Everyone was yelling at poor Sean O'Connell at Cinema Blend. He wrote that the movie wasn't for him, which... not really that controversial. Lots of movies aren't for lots of people. But also that because of its hyper-localized setting in Toronto and its intense focus on one subset of the local community, Asian immigrants, he couldn't imagine it appealing to anyone outside of that community. That was a mistake. People freaked out and still are to this moment, continuing to call for him to be fired for being so insensitive. For what it's worth, I'm more or less with him on the movie not being for me. Maylin has a sort of manic energy that one finds more likely to see in a DreamWorks movie than a Pixar joint. But it's fairly obvious that his point about the movie not appealing to anyone else is wrong because, you know, people go through puberty, particularly women. Right, Alyssa?
Particularly?
Particularly women.
Like more so or something?
As the women in this, I figured it was, you know, I want to emphasize the puberty.
Lady bits, tampons, what can I say, folks?
Don't care for it.
Tell us about being an adolescent girl.
Oh, man. I thought this was delightful in part because it really gets what it's like to be a horny, awkward 13-year-old. I thought it was so sweet and funny. But also, it's about a subject that I think has been sort of less discussed, which is like female anger, right? It is a story about dealing with, you know, like rage and humiliation and all of these feelings that kind of become more intense when you become a teenager and start pushing up against the edges of what your parents want for you. And that's something that I think is like actually a fairly universal experience. Like the whole you're not the boss of me of it all. But I thought that this channeled the experience of being 13 really well, despite the fact that, as we discussed a little bit before the podcast, some of the details have kind of been tweaked to make the specifics of teenhood in 2002 comprehensible to, you know, preteens and teens today. You know, there's an early sequence in the movie where Malin is sketching in a notebook and she kind of has this awakening that she thinks the guy who works at the local convenience store is like real cute, right? And you just see that realization happening in a full body way that, you know, it comes on her sort of slowly. And then she kind of grabs the notebook to her chest, sinks to the floor, and just rolls under the bed in a very cute and stylized illustration of what it's like to just need to be alone with these weird, intense feelings that have come over you with the force and immediacy of a blush. And that just the sort of the physicality of Malin's experiences in the movie, like, you know, the red panda is the metaphor for puberty. It's like a little on the nose, but at the same time, the sense that your body is suddenly and radically in transition, sometimes in ways that are like cool and pleasurable, and sometimes in ways that are just gross and weird and disorienting. I thought, again, really well done and honestly kind of unusual for a movie at this size, right? I mean, most of the time, you know, animated characters are either, you know, sort of past the onrush of the physical awkwardness of adolescence, right? Like all of the classic Disney princesses are like, they're through puberty, they've got it all figured out, they look great, you know, they're like, they know how to dress for their bodies, their bodies have sort of settled into that shape, or they're children. And so all of this is just really far away. It's not off the radar. And, you know, this is not a movie that like, you know, gets into details of like shaving your legs or like actually putting in a tampon or anything. But the sort of physical and emotional ickiness is there on the screen in a way that I found sort of unusual and refreshing for an animated movie. And I think that the, you know, one thing that the movie does really well, you know, I mean, I think there have been some discussions about whether the depiction of relationships between mothers and daughters, particularly in Asian and Asian American communities, is a little bit cliche. But I thought that the movie handles the sort of similarity between mothers and daughters and how that's actually the thing that becomes, you know, the point of tension and revulsion in those relationships. I thought that was really well developed, that in order to become yourself as a teenage girl and as a young woman, you have to break away from your mother. And that's something that can be really liberating, but can also be really painful because it can involve rejecting qualities that you yourself have.
And it's also that the mom is worried that the daughter is going to have the same problem that she knows she has in herself. And
exactly.
She's worried because she knew that it was hard for her to deal with something. And she's like concerned that her daughter will not effectively deal with the difficult thing that has that like she knows that she dealt with. And in a way that we find out is larger even than her daughter's.
Yep.
Like if we were going to call it a problem, larger even than the issue.
Inconvenience, right?
The difficulty, right? I mean, it's like it doesn't have to be, but it is like it's certainly presented as a like
it's a problem.
Yeah,
it's changing into a giant monster. I want to say that just like the Incredible Hulk.
Sonny, you and I know that the boy version of this would present it as just like the boy would be like, hell yes, I'm a freaking giant panda monster. This is awesome.
It's the Incredible Hulk. It's just, and that's always like the sad walking away music at the end of every episode. It's a sad thing when you turn into a monster when you get angry. That's a bad thing.
We all know a bunch of dudes who wish they looked like Lou Ferrigno.
The actual comparison here is Teen Wolf, right? Yeah. Have you guys seen Teen Wolf?
Yeah.
Like when I was nine or something.
If I can just finish at the point though, but
one thing,
the movie I think that I was glad it included is that, you know, adolescence if you're a girl, if you have a great dad, that can be a moment when you and your dad start to really get to know each other, because your dad can be the person who kind of explains your mother to you and explains you to your mother and can be sort of a neutral intermediary, in part because you're different. And, you know, as a teenage girl who got really close to my dad and remains really close to my dad, in part because we're both writers, we're both journalists, and high school was the time when he was starting to really teach me to write in a serious way, I just loved seeing the interactions between Maylin and her dad on screen, and seeing actually, as in Coda, the moment when her dad sort of becomes the person who recognizes the full extent of her talent and supports her in becoming different from her family. I just thought that was a really nice emotional touch. Also, this movie looks gorgeous. I mean, the combination of the like hyper-stylized anime stuff and then the like the beauty of the hyper-real animation of like things like flowers, ingredients in food, et cetera, I thought just came across really nicely on the screen. So that's a side note. Not a fan?
Disagree. I actually didn't like the overall look of it, and I really hated the like anime eyes, like rainbow eye thing that was constantly happening. I didn't care for the look of this movie very much at all, to be honest. But
okay,
Peter,
that, I think that's a matter of taste.
I mean, I'm sorry, Peter. I'll come to you in one second. The other thing that, and what I was kind of hinting at was it is manic in a very real way.
Yeah,
that I find displeasing. It is tonally just displeasing to me to be surrounded by that much energy. I need to be a little more laid back.
Yeah. Sorry, you would have really hated me in middle school and high school. I was unbearable.
I was going to ask, is this like the Alyssa Rosenberg kind of, I feel like there's a lot of overachieving here and like, you know.
So I never wanted to tell you guys, but actually the moon is full. I'm really, really honked.
Wait, can I get a picture?
Yeah, for $5 so I can go to the Four Town concert. Absolutely, you can get a picture.
All right, Peter, what did you make of this movie?
I mostly enjoyed Pixar's Chinese Canadian remake of Belfast. Like this is a Belfast. This is an odd movie in that it is an intensely personal, culturally specific, basically a period film of the sort that like indie directors used to make about like, oh, this is my coming of age movie, right? This is my memoir film. It was very common sort of introductory movie for young up and coming directors to make. And this is Domi Shi's first feature film. She's directed one short film before, which was really great. I actually liked it a little better than this movie. It's called Bao. It was just about a family making little dumplings, and it's just delightful. But this is just like a classic indie director's first movie, except that it's filtered through the lens of Pixar and genre, and it has a $175 million budget attached. And you talked about the review that got taken down because the guy said, look, this movie is just too specific, not only for me to relate to, but for anyone to relate to. And what I thought was that this movie was at its best when it was doing cultural and time-based specifics. So I don't relate to being a 13-year-old girl, but I am interested in very specific stories of individual people and places. And this movie captured a lot, not perfectly, but an awful lot about being a teenager in the early aughts, right? I think it has been somewhat filtered through the age of, you know, social media, in the sense that like there's a few too many phones involved. A few too many of them have cameras, right? And like in the end, like the second act, I should say, is like basically she decides to become a pre-social media Instagram influencer and use that to make money. And yet, this is a movie that really gets a lot of the details right in a way that you just don't see very often at this budget level, and that is really pretty enjoyable. And like, I really enjoyed, once the movie got going, I thought it worked very well. And all those time-specific details and place-specific details were really neat. And I enjoyed that aspect of it in a lot of ways more than I enjoyed sort of the, oh, this is the 13-year-old girl story. And I think the movie, like, to the extent that I think it has flaws, I think the biggest problem is, it's a little bit what you were talking about, Sonny, is the manicness of the main character. And this movie has, like, takes on, I think, a difficult challenge, and it doesn't completely surmount it, but it takes on the challenge of telling a story about a character that it acknowledges is kind of annoying. And that's like built into being this type of 13-year-old girl. And the movie just says that up front. Like there's this scene in which, you know, like she announces who she is and she's telling the world about how awesome she is and what a wonderful overachiever. And then there's a little montage of how other people see her. And like one of the, I think it's Tyler who, you know, on the basketball court is like, and she's really annoying. And she's like, you know what? I accept this. And she shoots the basketball and just completely.
I embrace all labels.
Right. Yeah. I embrace all labels, whatever. Right. Like she's totally fine with it. But it says, look, it basically seems to like acknowledge to the viewer up front, this character's annoying, but we think she has a valuable story to tell anyway. And again, I think that's a difficult thing to do. And the movie doesn't quite do it because like doesn't quite overcome this challenge, especially in the first act. But once it gets going, there's so much that's really nice here and so much that's really specific and interesting because it is specific. The little is it a Tamagotchi or a Neopet or like the little electronic pet thing,
I think it's
right?
a Tamagotchi.
Which I had Tamagotchi. Just completely forgotten about. I thought the light integration of anime art was great. So director Domi Shi comes out of being a big anime fan, was like the president of her anime club in high school and did a lot of like fan art, right? That's how she got her start first as an artist and was really involved in that community. And I think you can really see how that has shaped, you know, some of her sensibility here. And it's just, it's not a great movie exactly, but it's really a pretty good one. And it's interesting as an artifact of like, this is what Pixar, and in some ways only Pixar right now can do, is tell a non-franchise story about a very specific, very individual person in a specific time and make that for $175 million targeted towards like a huge audience that like, you know, towards a four quadrant audience of adults and children, and can make it so that like, even I am a 40-year-old guy with no kids. And I thought this movie had a lot going for it. And a lot to really like.
Yeah, I mean, when you said that, the other studio that can do this sort of thing is A24, but their
yes,
their budget is
in
like the $3 to $6 million range.
I mean, occasionally yeah, they'll spend $25 million on a film, but yeah, yes, mostly it's stuff that's done for under $12 million, yeah, and that's
imagine
the difference.
Pixar
here.
Making an A24
movie.
And
you think
movie,
about what is you know, what's the last Pixar movie we talked about on this podcast was Soul, which was again just this like weirdly culturally specific, like a black man in his middle age, jazz teacher, feels like a failure. And then it gets filtered through the lens of like crazy genre stuff because Pixar always wants to have those elements in their movies. But it's a movie about like middle age dejection
ennui,
and the
yeah,
sense that like yeah, your life isn't going to come to anything. Again, it's just an indie film from 1993. It's like you can totally imagine that being a promising first director's work, you know, at like that Miramax would have spent $12 million on and then mounted an Oscar campaign and they would have won best screenplay. Except no, this is a $200 million movie that Trent yeah, Reznor is scoring, and it can like we- has Disney's backing. I yeah, think that like that stuff is valuable, and even if this particular movie isn't perfect, I'm really glad that this sort of thing is being made.
Can we just talk a little bit about the release strategy here? Because I think it's very interesting. Like, Soul is a movie that I think made a little bit more sense to release on Disney Plus. As you say, it's basically about a middle-aged guy who's trying to, you know, figure out his place in the world
and what he's done with it.
The concept is very
really
weird. The score is great, but it's a little bit weird. I mean, like, it's essentially a Pixar art film. That's like, yeah, that's kind of what it. But this is a much broader movie that would appeal. I watched it with my 6-year-old daughter, and she had a fine time. She enjoyed it. My 3-year-old was a little bit scared at the red panda, but you know, whatever. Kids enjoyed it. It's the sort of movie that absolutely could have played in theaters, even if you want to have this on Disney Plus pretty quickly, you know, within 28 days or you know, 40 days or whatever. It just feels to me like Disney is leaving money on the table by not putting it in theaters and giving families who are looking to go to the movie something to go see. I mean, look at the Sing 2's performance. Yeah. Sing 2's been out on VOD for like 5 weeks now, and it's in that time has still made like another $40 or $50 million at the box office after being out for 6 weeks before that. Like I'm kind of befuddled by what they're doing here.
Yeah, it's interesting. I mean, you mentioned your three-year-old not being like super into it. And we tried watching it with our three-year-old too, who I think was put off kind of by the manic energy. And when I watched it all the way through, I realized like, oh, you know, I'm not quite ready to explain menstruation to a three-year-old. Like,
luckily, my six-year-old didn't ask any questions.
My three-year-old definitely would have. And so it's like, it's a family movie, but it's not quite one that I think like 4 or 5 year olds are necessarily going to resonate to. And so I do think it is a little bit more narrow cast. That said, this is the kind of movie that I totally can imagine going to see at the mall like 2 or 3 times when I was 13 with my friends. And I have no idea how much, you know, Disney knows about whether 13-year-olds go to the movies at the mall anymore. Maybe they just don't. Maybe they're all living in the metaverse all the time. That's where Bob Iger thinks we're all going. So maybe he's got something right there. But
an entire economy based on Sunny Bunch NFTs.
Finally, it's about time.
You heard it here first, folks. Across the movie aisle is economy of the future. But I do wonder a little bit if it's like, I think it's actually like targeted an interesting sweet spot in a lot of ways, right? Like it reminds me more of like Lady Bird or Booksmart, again, with like $175 million budget than it does necessarily like a pure all ages family movie. So in that sense, I don't know that they're necessarily wrong.
I think you have to think about when this decision was made, and it was the first week of January, and Omicron just looked like it was tearing the theatrical experience apart, with the weird exception of Spider-Man, which somehow or another, like every other movie, was just being killed at the box office. And Spider-Man was doing really well, but nothing else seemed to be able to break through. And it wasn't clear how long this was going to last at that point. Like this decision was made very late. This is only about 2 months ago. And that was after last summer they had promised a theatrical release. So I just think that like, corporations are really having a difficult time figuring out how to react to the waves of infection that we have seen over the last couple of years, and when to change their office return policies, when to bring people into movie theaters, when to send stuff to your streaming business, which is, after all, like what, at least I should say, I am not sure that streaming is the entirety of the future, but Disney is looking at Disney Plus as their future. And Disney Plus has done increasingly well over the pandemic. I mean, if you think about like the business model there, most people, even before the pandemic, saw like one movie a year in the theater or something like that.
Sure.
And if the business model is you can collect money from people every single month eventually they cancel their subscription 5 years from now.
Yeah,
driving people to Disney Plus with family content in particular is not a completely stupid strategy, even if it creates weird financial incentives, you know, and issues. I mean, in the short term.
But the question is how many people signed up for Disney Plus specifically to see this? They're like, oh, Turning Red's coming to Disney Plus. I better go sign up right now to see it. Or how many would have canceled if they were like, oh, well, why would I sign up for Disney Plus if I have to pay to go watch Turning? I think the answer is zero.
I think the answer is
zero people would have made a decision on either way here. And I think they're leaving $150 million on the table. I think this movie would have made $150 million at the box office, even with a shortened window. And that's just a mistake. I'm on my theater hobby horse now, so I'll hop off. But I think it's a mistake.
I am not sure it's a mistake. And I guess I would say that, you know, as someone with close access to Disney's financials and all of their secret data, like we have no idea, but clearly Disney has a lot of information and they spend a lot of money trying to figure out what causes people to sign up and what causes people to stop paying for their subscriptions. And I'm sure that right now a lot of that information is evolving and they don't have perfect data because the streaming world is relatively new to them. And so to some extent, it is probably worth really quite a large amount of money. I don't know about $150 million, but quite a large amount of money simply to gather data on what keeps people subscribing and what gets people to sign up.
Yeah. All right. So what do we think? Thumbs up or thumbs down on Turning Red? Peter?
Thumbs up.
Alyssa?
Thumbs up.
Qualified thumbs down for me. Didn't care for it. That is it for this week's show. If you loved it, make sure to check out our members-only bonus episode coming Friday to atma.thebulwark.com on Pixar movies and what we like about them. Make sure to tell your friends. Strong recommendation from a friend is basically the only way to grow podcast audiences. We don't grow, we will die. If you did not love today's episode, please complain to me on Twitter at SunnyBunch. I'll convince you that it is, in fact, the best show in your podcast feed. See you guys next week.